This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, and welcome to Outward, Slate's LGBTQ podcast. I'm Brian Lauder, an editor at Slate, and this week we've got a little bit of an old-school Slate spoiler special about season 4 of HBO's True Detective, which this time around is subtitled Night Country, and stars Jodie Foster and Kali Reis as hard-nosed detectives investigating murder, corporate malfeasance, and mystery in the Alaskan town of Ennis during its period of perpetual night because it's north of the Arctic Circle. So just a little warning to listeners, we are going to be talking about the whole 6-episode season, which just wrapped up this past weekend, with a really pretty, let's say, bracing finale might be a good word for it. So if you haven't watched that yet and you plan to, I would save this episode until after you've caught up, and then we'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection, to the opening arguments, to the witness testimony and cross-examination, and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
All right, so why are we going to be talking about this show on the Queer Podcast, you may be asking? Well, that's because, as my colleague Madeline Ducharme put it in a recent piece, a thorough investigation has led me to a veritable glacier of evidence that suggests that lesbianism is just as pervasive in the town of Ennis as Cyclops polar bears and mysterious rolling oranges. End quote. I am pleased Madeline was able to step over from producing Slate's daily news show What Next to unpack that tantalizing sentence for us. Madeline, welcome back to Outward.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I hate copaganda, but I do like when the cops are hot dykes beating up like bad men who hurt women.
And that is how they get us. Yeah.
No, that is how they get us. It's totally. Really, really.
It's like
we're really simple creatures. I can be pleased pretty easily, it seems.
So just as a quick vibe check, before we really get into everything, how are you feeling after that finale? Are you feeling shook? Are you feeling even more sapphic than before?
Okay, I was thinking every part of the finale, every development until probably the last 12 minutes were so utterly preposterous that I was just sort of, I was having fun. I was like, this is so silly. And I do think that the original season one of True Detective had a similar feeling where everything was so utterly convincing until we got to the finale and everything got kind of John Wickian, like just so ridiculous.
That's a good word, yeah.
And then we got to the last like 12 minutes or so and I felt like somebody at HBO like preemptively in the past read this piece that I wrote obviously after they made this show and they gave me what I wanted. And so that was...
There was some time as a flat circling happening with your piece.
Yes.
and the writing.
Oh my God, that's exactly it.
Yeah. All right, Madeline, you open your piece, which is titled All the Signs That Point to Lesbianism in True Detective Night Country, with a close reading of the line, "We're all in Night Country now." That's the line that I think I need you to share with our listeners and do that. And then also just remind us sort of who the key players are in your analysis that are up on your lesbian corkboard of investigation.
Oh my God, my corkboard. Exactly. Okay. Well, Night Country to me, because of the certain syllables in that word and because night leads me to kind of like think about darkness, think about, cavernous spaces.
Yes.
And I do think the first syllable of the word country does sound like something that lesbians know well. It evokes cunning lingus to me. especially if we're all in it now. I think we're all diving in. That's exactly where I want to be. But this show is not making that. For the record, they're not making this a part of their branding at all. But the fact that somebody says we're all in the night country now and the people who he's saying it to are, one, Jodie Foster, Hollywood's like lesbian legend, who was like pretty much known as queer before, even before she came out. And when she did, it was sort of defiant and kind of like, yeah, I mean, obviously, like she did say she was gay about 1,000 years ago back in the Stone Age. And that was... That was something she said 10 years ago, which I think is wonderful. And also to Callie Reese, who I think is just a kind of lesbian wet dream. She is so, so gorgeous and tatted up, so, so brawny, big giant muscles, but has like a very tender and caring face, even in spite of the sort of menacing dimple piercings, which I don't know if you've ever like held your cheek, but that is a lot of skin to get through. And I mean, who, you can't be a queer person without the eyebrow slit. I guess I don't have it, but that's because I'm not cool enough. So when you hear a quote like that said to these two people, I couldn't help but think like, what are they speaking to here?
Your piece is sort of framed around like excavating this, right? Because you say that the show, you have this great turn of phrase actually, that the show is queerly heterosexual, which I loved. I love that use of, you know, the sort of more traditional use of queer as like strange. Like what, like why is it?
Perplexing.
Perplexing, yeah. So what do you mean by that? And, you know, You write, actually, why on earth this show seems determined to sidestep the queerness that threatens to erupt in every intense moment on screen. What do you see about that sort of suppression that's going on?
Well, our two main characters are, despite, like, every nonverbal signal about them, despite the way that they fill the frame, despite the way they interact with each other, and we can get to that in a second, they're constantly tracking down men to have like very domineering, intense sex with.
Yes.
And these are often people they work with, used to work with, they might work with in some way. And they are, there's a lot of sex in the show actually. And I don't think it's not hot. I think it's good. They're good sex scenes, but they are all with men. And it's, it was surprising that the two main characters who, for every other signal would point to lesbianism, are having these like kind of very almost like animalistic, like sexual encounters with the men that they are in town with. I mean, it seems like the Jodie Foster character has slept with just about everyone's husband. And it's like...
It does, right?
Yeah, she's like the police chief who also has enemies with every single woman in town because she sleeps with the teacher here who teaches geology. She sleeps with the police chief down in Anchorage. She's like she talks about being on Tinder. She's like clearly prowling for people's husbands.
But you do write in your piece, actually, this is another great line, you know, in their dalliances throughout the perpetual night, the men function more like a human dildo for these women who are often on top, which is totally true in terms of just the, like, blocking of the scenes, and then, like, total control. So there is, a flipping of maybe what would be expected from a normal hetero coupling in that regard.
I also think that the sex scenes are not really about connection with those men at all. In fact, they're very much about like blowing off steam. And I do think the men in the show get treated the way that the women of season one get treated, which is that they're sort of there to juxtapose and show how serious our main two detectives are. Everybody else is completely silly, unserious, not taking anything to the extent that they need to take it to. They're not working hard enough. And I think that our two main characters, Navarro, played by Callie Reese, and Danvers, they need somebody who is not thinking about this as seriously as them to be able to, like, to be able to just, like, blow off steam because nobody is as serious as the true detectives.
Well, it's like Danvers in particular seems to never sleep or eat, or like there's like she's truly only ever working, or I think these occasional, like you said, sort of steam valve release, like sexual encounters, but that's it.
Yeah,
right, because she's so serious all the time. Yeah, let's back up a little bit and talk about the relationship between Navarro and Danvers.
Sure.
I loved this sort of close reading you do of the can cabinet scene in the kitchen. Before I read your piece and was just watching the show for pleasure, I noticed this too as a sort of strange little moment of frisson between them. So can you describe that scene, what happens in that scene, and then sort of what you get out of it?
Yeah, so the thing about Danvers and Navarro is that they did used to work together. And
right.
they sort of stumble into working together again because Navarro doesn't actually work for Danvers's department.
It's like the municipal police and the
state trooper. Yeah, exactly. And the show sort of slowly unspools that reasoning, and it's because of a shared case they have, which we can get to later. But when this story, this particular murder, and this particular mystery brings them back together, they have a kind of bitterness going on, but it's like a familiar bitterness. They seem to know each other really, really well. And one of the things that happens is Danvers is really comfortable just like walking herself into anybody's home. she's particularly her...
Without a warrant, just like going,
just walking in. And particularly the people who are her subordinates at work, she's very comfortable intruding on their personal lives. And... she sort of busts into Navarro's kitchen, sees that there are groceries on the counter. Navarro has just run out to get, you know, whatever, $20 cans of tuna because they live in the Arctic Circle.
Oh, that's right. The price is the Oreos that are like $40.
$20,
yeah.
Danvers, like, is so at home that she starts unloading the groceries and joins her. And there's a moment where she's really maybe like a little too mad for what the problem was. But that sort of like just shows how serious she is.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, did you change where you put the cans? And that is such a like telling turn of phrase because it means I used to know where the cans were and they're not there right now. And I'm really mad at you that I don't know where the cans are. And it seems to suggest because I don't know where Brian's cans are, for example, even though we've worked together for now almost, four and a half years.
The upper left, if you ever need to find them. Yeah.
Right. But you know whose cans I do know where they are? My girlfriend's.
Yes.
just putting that out there. I definitely know where her cans are. And, you know, that's the kind of thing you might know if you woke up in the morning after a very, very beautiful night together, and you're looking to get a caffeine fix. You're digging around in the closet or digging around in the cabinet for the coffee and you see, okay, the cans are there. I'm going to keep that in mind. And that's also something you might learn after a few visits, a few mornings at somebody's
place. Maybe you're even going to make, you know, try to make some pancakes or something. And you're like, where's that?
Right. I need the Bisquick.
The Bisquick, right. Where is the Bisquick? No, totally. I mean, I think you're reading. That was really a striking moment between them that I think is probably should be one of the biggest, like, you know, data points on your corkboard.
Because
it's truly, truly odd otherwise. Okay, so going further along, there's a discussion between Danvers and Navarro when they're driving somewhere, and they're sort of talking about their, like, past hookups and that kind of thing. And Danvers asks Navarro if she's gone back to girls.
Right.
So this, I believe, is the most explicit reference that we get in the show to that moment anyway. So tell us a little bit about that.
It's a full HR violation, by the way, to, like, press your subordinate.
The show was not a place to look for a model of workplace safety and fairness.
But it's kind of a sexy little HR violation. It's a tease. It's like the kind of thing that I feel like we might say to, you know, a past lover, a past paramour who has now, like, getting into little heterosexual nonsense, very obviously. And you might say, like, oh, yeah, well, you still up to that with him? I mean, and he's a very sweet guy. We like Kavik, the guy that Navarro
Kavik, Kavik is the sweetest. Oh, my God.
Such a sweetie pie. One might even say kind of like a very thoughtful, sweet lesbian. But that's neither here nor there. But it obviously gestures towards the fact that Navarro has had relationships with women, sexual, romantic, unclear how serious any of them were, but she definitely has. And actually, in the episode that followed the publication of this piece, she was talking to Navarro about Navarro's sort of, like, teen stepdaughter who's been acting out. And like, well, she's got this girlfriend, is what Danvers says. And Navarro's like, oh, who cares? I have plenty of those or whatever. And I was like, picking it up. So she's definitely into women. And I just think if my boss or former boss was comfortable enough to say something like, oh, have you gone back to girls now? I don't know. It suggests that maybe that kind of teasing is coming from a place that's not just HR violation, workplace dynamic. It's coming from a place of, like, I can tease you about that because we once had a connection.
Like, we have
in that
some
way.
Kind of history.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of I love teasing my, like, exes. It's like, it's a fun, silly thing to, like, poke fun at them and their new connections because you had been there first, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Let's take a quick break here, and then when we come back, I want to talk about the figure of the mommy. We will just take a quick break, and we'll be back with Madeline after that.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
All right, we're back. So like I said, later on in your piece, Madeline, you bring up the figure of the mommy in sort of lesbian culture, which is the equivalent for the gays out here of the daddy, which makes sense, right? And you ascribe this in particular in the context of this show to Danvers. Talk about that, because I thought that was such a smart reading of her like vibe in general and just what she's up to. And tell us about the mommy, because I think we all need to learn about it.
Yeah, I actually think I wrote this paragraph as a refutation of the argument that somebody might make about this dynamic, to be like, no, she's really more of like a maternal figure. Mm, and actually, the actors themselves have said, I think it was Callie Reese who said, like, Danvers is really maternal and has like a maternal posture towards Navarro. And I actually think that's part of the sexual dynamic they have.
I think
gay mentorship between two romantic partners is something that is just like completely a part of lesbian and gay culture. And I do think I stole the idea of the mommy with M-O-M-M-I-E from a great piece that was written in Autostraddle in 2017. Uh-huh. And they were really interested in the mommy as a character who is like an actual mother, which Danvers actually is too, but is really put together, really beautiful characters like the women in Big Little Lies are kind of mommies. I actually think the Danvers version of the mommy is much, much sexier. You know, instead of being, wearing like Prada to pick up your kids from school, she's kind of hyper competent. She's prickly. She has everybody just in the palm of her hand. Like, she's so powerful in her workplace. You know, one of her younger charges is a new-ish dad. His kid seems to be like 2 or 3. And his wife, they're both very young. They're probably in their early 20s. His wife is trying to go to school, and he can just be like just a snap. And Danvers can get him to like show up to the office.
Totally.
Sit and watch corpses like melt in the ice rink.
In the ice rink. Oh my God.
Like,
yeah.
You're a dad, but somehow you are more beholden to mommy.
That's the mommy, mommy's calling. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's also there's a little moment. I'm really close reading now, real corkboard feeling. But there is a little moment where Jodie Foster, who is very small, I think she's about 5'1", is trying to reach for some coffee that is like on top of a cabinet in the station. And she doesn't even like use words, but she sort of snaps at a nameless cop who's sitting just outside.
Yes.
Like, gets him to, like, snaps and kind of points, and he just, like, immediately rises and grabs the coffee and hands it to her. Like, she's powerful. And, I mean, she's got a gun. That's kind of sexy in TV, not in real life.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I also
symbolically.
I also think the Fiona Shaw character, who doesn't have a ton to do besides be kind of wise and put out a beautiful Christmas spread, she is like a mommy goat to me. You know, there's a great scene in Fleabag where she has a very small part in season 2 of Fleabag, where the main character played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge is talking about wanting to fuck the priest, the hot priest. Fiona Shaw has this like indelible line that I like always think of, which is the, are you sure you want to fuck a priest or do you want to fuck God? And she says it so casually. Fleabag says back, can you fuck God? And she says, oh, yes. And there's something about her that I've always felt drawn to in a way that I was like, oh, this woman knows all. She knows all in Fleabag. She knows all in Night Country. She's mommy, you know?
She's totally mommy. No, I the only regret really that I had about this series in terms of length, because there's only 6 episodes, like I mentioned at the top, I felt like there should have been like another, just maybe one more episode that was sort of a capsule episode about her character.
Yes.
Because I love
her. What's she doing there?
What's she doing? She's being kind of like a witch or something, like up in the, like.
Yeah, she seems to kind of rise above the Ennis bullshit that is happening that everybody else is so steeped in. And that in and of itself is kind of appealing and alluring. And she has a dynamic with Navarro that like, it's kind of never explained. I was sort of perplexed by it. Mm-hmm. But it made me envious. I was like, I want a Fiona Shaw that I can go shack up with on Christmas Eve because I'm alone and devastated. And she's going to have like crudité
and tea,
and brandy and like wearing this sexy velvet dress. It's like she wasn't expecting you. Why is she so glamorous because just for herself?
Because she's mommy and mommy gets to have all of that
exactly.
all the time.
Exactly.
So let's see. One thing that you pick up on in your piece, which I think is important to mention before we end, is that there's also just sort of due to the indigenous setting of this show in Alaska, there's a matriarchal kind of culture that's like shown to us too. Especially, I'd actually say in the final episode. Do you just want to talk a little bit about that aspect of the show and how this sort of, you know, fits within what you're arguing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is a really beautiful scene. I actually think it's like one of the best scenes of the whole show, even though it's a little bit more incidental to the actual mystery. And I actually wish the show was longer so we could get more scenes like this. They're giving you texture of all these characters, one of our season's murder victims. And it's Navarro shows up to arrest one of the season's murder victims back when she was alive. And she's like really dead set on arresting her for protesting at the mine. And
mm-hmm. There's like pollution issues happening. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a very righteous thing that the character did. And where she finds her is this birth center where a woman, an Inupiaq woman is going to give birth. And Navarro's kind of stunned by it. And it's only women there. There's no other like father and figure involved. It's really just like probably half a dozen women who are all really supporting and taking care of each other and bringing into the world like a whole new person. And I think there's this bond that you can feel among the women of that community, which is an important bond to like set the standard for because of the finale. I mean, like we said, the finale was getting pretty preposterous. They kill the character that seems to have the only information.
Right.
It's like, what is going on? And there's still, 25 minutes left. And it's like, okay, well, somebody's going to explain to me what happened here. And through a series of also ridiculous explanations and things like that.
Yeah,
They find a definitive fingerprint that seems to lead them to back to the women who were the like cleaners.
Yeah,
of
the local
research station. And then we get a sort of awesome, I guess, kind of John Wickian.
that's true.
Like sequence where one of the women is telling a story, quote unquote, even though she's revealing the truth, obviously. And in which these women have banded together to avenge their,
the murder of their, friend.
Yeah. The murder of their friend. Exactly. And they do so in ways that are like deeply emasculating. They kind of force them into corners. They hold guns to them and force them to undress. And they give their friend, their murdered sister, the opportunity to killed them sort of through a metaphysical ghost kind of thing.
Yeah, they're like, either she'll take, if she wants them, she'll take them. And if she doesn't, their clothes are here. They can come back. And we'll see what, it's great. I mean, it's super great.
And that whole sequence is shot in such a way that is like, you kind of relish it. And it was the only moment where I was like, oh, this rocks, actually. This finale is amazing. Everything else was a little bit messy and I don't know. I couldn't wrap my head around most of it, but this sequence was delicious.
It was delicious, and again, it was this very powerful moment of the local indigenous community, like sort of exercising power, right, against the settler colonial folks that represented by the scientists. So we do have an ending that the actual very end of the series that I think probably goes on the corkboard. And we can sort of end our discussion there. But I'm curious. So we have, it seems like it does get a little hard to follow what's really happening and what's not. But it seems like at the very end, Navarro has sort of disappeared. She had, for a long time, she'd said she felt called to kind of wander out into the ice and, whatever that meant, I don't know exactly.
join the
spirit world.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what she was sensitive to spirits, and then, but we're not sure. But so there's a moment where Danvers' brother is going around and looking for her, and she's gone, doesn't show she's there. And then we get this final scene where Danvers is at like her beach house. I don't know where the house is exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of a lakeside cabin.
Yeah.
And it's summertime and it looks really beautiful. Like you have a back patio where you can like sip coffee and look out on the water.
And she brings out her coffee and sits on a couch. And then suddenly Navarro is there standing on the deck also.
Materializes and walks towards her.
Yes. And so I'm curious if you think that means, you know, that are they together? or is it the spirit of Navarro sort of just visiting Danvers, and maybe Danvers doesn't even see her because they are kind of blocked, like somewhat far apart. I don't know.
Right. But Danvers does say it's Ennis. No one ever really leaves.
She does say that. Yes. Yes. And it's very like American Horror Story, like Murder House. Like no one gets away.
I know. She said it like it was like a warm thing to say, but it was actually kind of distressing. But I think because she's saying, you know, you never really leave and no one really knows what happened to her, even though it seems to suggest, I mean, it's clearly one of those things where it's like, well, it could be either. I can take or leave those. But the fun thing about that is, okay, well, then they're obviously married and living together, and they're going to be there forever in their beautiful little lakeside cabin. even though I think the show would rather it be that she's a ghost, like, looking after her from the afterlife, which I also think is kind of gay.
it is super gay, yes.
Because it's funny, because it suggests that they had, like, that they really liked each other. Because if you're going to be in the afterlife and you're going to look after somebody, it would be somebody you love, right?
Sure.
But I don't even think these two women like each other very much. They just have a lot of tension, and they definitely, like, had some kind of very personal connection. So the thought that, like, the ghost herself would stick around to, to, like, watch over.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite the right chord to strike, but maybe now that they've solved the case, they can just be together. I don't know.
I think the official outward position will be that they are married. It could be on this physical plane, could be on the spiritual plane, but they are together forever. I like that idea. I think
totally.
I think they need a break, and that looks like a good place to have it.
Exactly.
I think everything is adding up on the corkboard to say the show is very lesbian. I'm very curious to hear if our listeners agree. Please reach out, as always, to outwardpodcast@slate.com to let us know what you thought about True Detective. We thought it was pretty fun and very, very gay. Speaking of gay, Madeline, I think you may have brought us a gay agenda item to share before you leave. Please do.
Okay, so an update to the gay agenda that I have is there's an excellent documentary, and it is unfortunately on Tubi, or maybe fortunately, because that means you can get it for free. But I do think you put something on Tubi and it has the veneer of like, oh, that's a Tubi movie, and like it means it's garbage and it's thrown together in 15 seconds or whatever. But it's a documentary that's called Shattered Glass, and it was created by the Women's National Basketball Association's Players Association. So that is their union. And this is happens to cross over in a lot of my interests. I got very into the WNBA, and I actually wrote a piece about getting very into the WNBA.
You did, yes.
You can find that on Slate.com. And I also am a part of our union here at Slate. I am very interested in labor politics. And the show, the documentary follows three women in the WNBA, two of whom are queer. And it follows them very closely about the sort of priorities that they have for their next contract and what they want for themselves, for their partners, for their families. And I think these two women that are queer that the documentary follows are just fascinating, dynamic, beautiful, amazing people. They're amazing athletes, but they're also just, I felt so close to them watching this documentary and thinking about their union fight and thinking about the things that they want to work for. You know, something as like unsexy as a pension. There's a moment where the sort of reigning MVP, her name is Brianna Stewart. She has two children, and her wife was actually pregnant at the time of the finals and like had the baby like just a few days after her team was in the finals. And it's like you can feel the sort of excitement. They have two children, and she's like, I can't believe we don't have a pension. We need a pension. And there's this urgency to it. And there's something so powerful about hearing this like athlete, this woman, this mother, this like lesbian advocating for something that they deserved long, long before.
Totally.
This.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I loved it. I just think everybody should watch it. I think it's a really interesting insight into labor politics. People don't think about athletes as workers, but they are.
But they are. Unions. Absolutely. They should. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's also just like a lot of really sweet gay moments between, yeah, Brianna Stewart, her wife, her two kids, and Jonquil Jones, who is also the other queer woman featured, and her fiance. They have very sweet moments. And it's worth it just to watch it for that.
Oh, that sounds so good. So it's called Shattered Glass on Tubi. Everyone go check that out. Yes, pensions are not sexy until you start drawing on them, and then I think they become very sexy.
That's the sexiest thing. Put it in your Tinder bio.
Yeah.
I'm 6'5", and I have a pension from Slate.
That's it. All right, Madeline, thank you so much again for coming. First, thank you for writing this wonderful piece, because I think you really did the important detective work on this season of True Detective. But also thank you for coming on the show. If you want to check out that piece again, it is called All the Signs That Point to Lesbianism in True Detective, Night Country by Madeline Ducharme. Madeline, as always, thanks for coming on Outward. We love having you.
Thanks so much, Brian. This was really fun.
All right, that is it for our show for this week. Please send us feedback and topic ideas as always at outwardpodcast@slate.com, or you can hit us up on Facebook or X at Slate Outward. Just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you can get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Working, and you will never ever hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more about that, go to slate.com/outwardplus. Our show is produced by Palace Shaw. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app. Tell your friends, family, lovers, everybody about it. Rate and review the show so that others can find it. We always appreciate that. And until next time, everybody, stay gay.